It's Saturday, June 19th, 2010, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, geek news in the first half, and in the second half, we'll be chatting with Andy Denmark from TripIt.com, a travel management website and mobile application suite service. Kind of cool. Anyway, the bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. It's time now for, what is it? Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during our program are not necessarily those of KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Al Luckow, a new media architect. Good morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
We also have Ben Jaffe, a freelance media guy.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Miles Elam, slacker and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
Five it is, huh?
Yeah, I'm on five, yes. Good morning.
Funny how that is.
Who's on first?
Who's on second? No, what's on second?
I don't know. Who's on third?
All right, yeah. We're not going to be as funny as the original, yeah. Sorry. All right, so let's go ahead and start with the news of the week. And Miles, I'm going to start with you. What's going on in San Francisco?
San Francisco has recently passed a cell phone radiation advertising law. In other words, when someone sells a cell phone, they have to say how much electromagnetic radiation is given off by the transmitter. Or by the transceiver. And some people have said, well, it's going to give the impression to people that one cell phone is healthier than another. If one cell phone, and this is the specific absorption rate, I should say it's not just the transmission energy, but how much it actually would be absorbed into the human body. And the federal government, the FCC, already limits cell phones to say they can have no greater than 1.6 watts per kilogram.
Okay.
So the thing is that 1.6 watts per kilogram has not been shown to cause any type of illness. Right. It was considered some arbitrary low threshold.
When you say kilogram, you're only talking about the weight of the phone.
No, it's per unit of the human body.
How much absorption would happen to the into
right?
The
how many watts
tissue
per
of the
amount
human.
Of tissue? Okay. Yeah,
you're talking about brain matter or skull matter. Okay,
right.
Go on.
And
but kilograms so, that only refers to people on the decimal system.
Right. So we're okay in America.
Yeah, we're all right here. Right.
But the
decimal
idea.
System.
But many people
metric,
in the industry
metric,
are.
I mean.
Yeah. Many
yeah.
people in the industry are fighting against it because if, for example, a cell phone has 1 watt per kilogram, another one has 0.9 watts per kilogram, there's no health difference that we're aware of
right.
between those two. At the same time, putting more information out there, you know, what yeah. people do with it is, it's similar to the same thing that people have with organic versus conventional foods.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To say, you know, there is that debate about whether or not it is healthier or not, or whether or not rinsing out the pesticides is enough.
Well, more nutritious. And
depends on
one
what
of
kind of warning is going to be enforced. If it's going to have like a warning on the outside of the package. And
oh, it's
phone.
Not about a warning.
It's
They're
just
not
about
talking about a warning.
It.
They're simply publishing the actual yeah. specific absorption rate. That's it.
Does that have completely to do with how effective the phone is? I mean,
oh, yes. If you limit the amount of energy being emitted by it, that means that your cell phone's going to have greater drop-offs. It's
right.
going to have lower bars.
I'm
in
assuming
area.
You could sell a cage for your phone that you'd plug into a ground line, right, and totally make a Faraday cage for your phone. And you're like, this has no immersion. And then, you know, by the way, you can use it in four places in San Francisco. You have to be next to the tower. You'd be on the tower.
You know? Right. You have to be next to the tower, in which case you're getting a higher absorption rate from the tower than you are from your cell phone.
Right. And, of course, loose definitions of the term That's... cell phone, in the sense you've got to, like, wire it to the tower. Okay, so what's the output of this? You're going to see this enforced? We're actually going to get
yes,
this?
Yes, well, it has been passed in San Francisco. So to sell cell phones in San Francisco, you do have to advertise that amount. Whether or not retailers will say, like, well, fine, we're not going to sell in San Francisco anymore. We'll leave the city and only sell there. Possible, unlikely, considering the market that San Francisco is. But at the same time, there's nothing really nefarious about this.
Yeah.
But it is relying on people to not freak out. And who knows? It's probably a good idea to have people say, Well, if I'm really worried about it, fine, get the cell phone that has worse reception. And if you can get, and if you decide, like, you know what, a little bit of risk is okay that I don't get dropped calls as much, then you do so.
I think it's very telling that the issue is, if you decrease that number, you decrease the effectiveness of the phone. It seems to me it would be really silly to, you're basically saying, do you want a cell phone or not? Do you want a good operating cell phone? But then again, you could get one that was doing tons more and has reception everywhere on the planet, but it was actually, you know, really hot. I guess that's something you want to keep track
of. Or comparatively hot. Once again, 1.6 watts per kilogram is really small.
Yeah. And the other thing about this is that it's possible that the better intelligence in the phone can produce less wattage and still have a good signal, right? So less use if it's a better signal separator. But that's only at the cell phone side, the receiving side. I would assume the sending side, you'd still have to have enough power.
It makes sense for the cell phone manufacturers to make phones that use less wattage and have better signal.
And it's in their interest.
They're trying to do that.
And to some degree, there's a term for that. It's called hours of talk time, right?
Right.
The less power you're using with your antenna system, the more
and
time
the better
you have
the
battery. And the better the battery, it's true. All right, well, thank you very much for that. Cool story. What's going on with the Xbox, Al?
Oh, yeah. This is something that's extremely cool, especially to a guy like me who bulk of my work is designing user interfaces and figuring out user experience. This new Xbox coming out, it's actually not a new Xbox. It's an addition to your existing Xbox. And the system is called Kinect, K-I-N-E-C-T. And it looks like, to me, some of the coolest technologies are finally making their way into the home. If you haven't seen or heard about this new Xbox thing, you really ought to watch the videos I posted. You can check that out after the show. I mean, we're talking games and interfaces completely controlled by gestures.
Right. It used to be called Project Natal.
Yes, it was called Natal, yes.
So if you've heard of Natal, you've heard of Kinect.
Kinect is the name for Natal. And if the Nintendo Wii is a VW Beetle, this new thing is like a Maserati. I've posted a couple videos. One is basically some sort of opening gala where lots of stars show up to play the games and say how much they like them. Because as we all know, movie stars are our most intelligent and well-informed leaders, and we should accept their opinions as
and
gospel.
Do everything they do.
Yes.
Yeah.
But needless to say, I'd take that part with a grain of salt. However, there's no denying this game is a game changer. The other video I posted shows a few of the games and how to play and interact with them. Basically, just imagine playing a game with no controller except your body. So, like, for a race game, you just hold your hands out like you're driving a car, and you could just turn your hands, and it senses where your hands are and turns the wheels. There's, like, running games where you're, like, running in place, and you're jumping over, you know, hurdles. I saw one where you're a dancer and you try to match the moves of another dancer on screen, and then your efforts are translated to, you know, a body of your choosing, and you get to dance next to them. And
now, Al, the only thing about this story that's kind of concerning me is that you just basically quoted Steve Ballmer. Are you comfortable with that?
You know, I'm not a gamer, and I really am not a big Microsoft fan, but I am a user interface guy, and when I saw this thing, I mean, I think, you know, we complain about our kids sitting and vegetating in front of World of Warcraft or whatever, whatever sedentary game is popular. But this new game actually might make them stand up and do something.
Because the interface requires
that. And the people that they show, you know, using them, they are actually jumping around. And I mean, I imagine there's probably going to be a couple of busted HD TVs sooner or later out of this. But it's even got a webcam in it that allows you to interact with other people, and you can watch movies. So and the syncing mechanism on it is such that it allows the two movies to sync. Like, normally you can't just watch a movie with somebody like over Skype because it's always going to be out of sync. But this allows you both to rent the same movie, you know, you link into it, and then you watch it at the same time, and you can comment. So you can
wearing,
you
headsets
know,
or something to do that.
No. And you're just watching you're both watching, and you're able to talk to each other at the same time. I don't imagine the video quality of the chat is that great, because anytime you have an all-in-one, you're going to run into these issues
said that you want people to be less sedentary, but now I can go watch a movie with Miles without even going to his house or him going to mine. We just watch.
Well, I think this is just another aspect of it. I think, like I said, I'm not really a gamer,
yeah,
but if I was to have a game, I might like these because they, I mean, they show people are learning Tai Chi and then there's somebody like doing it. And I remember trying to learn Tai Chi once and I'm looking at a book and standing there and trying to face the sun and it's crazy, you know, but you can do all this stuff like looking at that and then see your body translated on the screen. You just got to watch a couple of these videos and it's hard not to get excited about it because I've been waiting for this kind of interface for a real long time, you know.
And Miles, you, it sounds like you're familiar with the technology behind this. They're just using the webcam and analyzing that. Is that all they're doing?
As far as I'm aware, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
that's what I think too.
It looks pretty cool. I mean, there's little kids and you're like a lion and you're jumping and you're running, you know? I mean, they get
and
to,
you have to like
they have to crawl
to
and yeah, it's just you know?
Yeah, I would imagine you couldn't have a window behind that has like traffic going by or the lights. The lighting should be pretty consistent and you probably would need to have people sitting still while it initializes so it can
background. In the examples they showed people at a like a trade show trying it out, you know, at this opening gala, and there's stuff moving around behind them. So I don't know how, I don't really know how it's done. And you know, I mean, basically, when you get it, maybe you try it out and it really stinks or something. But you know, from the videos that I saw, you know, they got me excited.
In the art world, this kind of interactive stuff has been something that's been being played with for years, right? So I see this kind of work sometimes, and it seems to me it's always kind of this borderline of successful or not, but that they're getting it working and it's in people's hands is interesting. Of course, if you've got like a little yappy jumping dog, they're gonna mess up your game all the time. There's gonna be encounters where somebody brings in some chips and they walk in front of the screen and your character crashes into the wall or whatever.
They actually showed somebody walk in bringing chips and everybody was sitting down watching a Harry Potter movie and the guy goes, Xbox, pause. And, you know, you just, you talk to it, and it just, you know, it's almost like Star Trek and Jetsons and all this stuff, and, you know, I don't know, if they have this thing working, I think these are, this is the first step in just getting rid of the keyboard and the console.
And, yeah, then your best friend walks in the room and says, delete all saved games.
Yeah.
All right, so on my one of my duties in Geek Speak, pretty much the only thing I have to do, is kind of lead into your guys' stories, right, and then ask questions. And normally I try to, like, make a connection. And Miles' first story was about cell phone laws in San Francisco. And then Al's story is about Xbox Connect, this great thing we just talked about. And I couldn't make a connection between those. And I can't make a connection to the next one because there's nothing here. Sperm whales are carbon neutral, Ben? Where does the story come from?
Okay, so here's how I was going to pitch the story, right? Okay. So I was looking up some statistics. Humans apparently exhale about 0.84 tons of carbon dioxide annually based on the figure that I found. Sperm whales, however, they exhale 200,000 tons of carbon each year. And so this seems like it would be a problem.
In the same metabolic process that we
have. Yeah, I mean, it's partially a closed loop and everything because they're inhale. Yeah, but in any case, that's about how much they exhale. That's a lot of carbon dioxide. So we think maybe of sperm whales. I mean, they're breathing a lot. They're exhaling a lot of CO2. But it turns out that sperm whales, in the kind of a weird roundabout way, are carbon neutral. In fact, they actually sequester carbon. They actually pull 400,000 tons of carbon out of the atmosphere every year, whereas they breathe 200,000. So for every sperm whale, it's offsetting how much it
and I'm assuming it's going into its
and the mechanism
fecal matter,
for this.
The mechanism for this.
So there is the, is it from eating or is it from breathing?
So here's what happens.
Okay.
So plants sequester carbon just intrinsically the way they
so
work,
they
right?
Their system, their structures.
The sperm whale doesn't actually sequester the carbon. What the sperm whale does, so sperm whales, they eat mostly things like squid in the deep ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they come up to the surface and they poop closer to the surface and their feces are very rich in iron, iron stimulates the growth of phytoplankton. Phytoplankton trap carbon. And then phytoplankton die, and it sinks down to the bottom of the ocean.
Ah, interesting.
So
it's actually a life cycle with the whale.
Exactly. So it's kind of crazy. It's like they're eating the squid in the deep ocean, going up to the top, depositing the iron in their feces, and then stimulating growth of phytoplankton, which then sinks to the ground. Yeah.
Cool.
So it's effectively sequestering tons and tons and tons of carbon down to the seafloor.
Tons and tons and tons. Right.
Yeah. In fact. 400,000 tons, in fact.
A year per whale.
One every year per whale.
That's a lot. That's a lot of growing trees.
That's a lot. I mean, again, we exhale less than 1 ton annually.
Wow.
Now I'm going to be the total pedant and talk about, A ton is a unit of gravitational attraction, like of weight, like poundage.
Yes.
But it's not of mass. So how do you talk about the tonnage of CO2 and still be accurate?
I think that they're assuming they mean mass level.
I mean, a kiloton, like in the metric system, sure.
I think you can still...
A metric ton, yeah.
You can still say a ton in our atmosphere. Because our atmosphere weighs something.
You can say pounds of CO2, too.
It weighs something because of the gravity. But a kilogram on the Earth versus a kilogram in orbit is the exact same mass because kilogram is a unit of mass,
if you take a box and you have carbon dioxide in it and you weigh it, it'll weigh a certain amount. But if you instead take that box and make it a vacuum inside and tear your scale based on the weight of it as in a vacuum, then the CO2 will register as weighing something.
Yeah, the air weighs something.
Air has mass. And yes, it does, and therefore it will weigh something when in the gravitational
field. So you don't like
field.
That we're using something that talks about it
no,
being
like
a
I said,
weight.
I'm playing the part of the pedant.
Okay.
And I'm
congratulations.
Totally just like being annoying and nitpicky, but at the same time we're geek speak, and I feel like it's a public service to to point out the little things just so people are aware they exist. You can ignore it; just it's all fine. I usually do.
You know, I think he might be talking about those space whales, like from Star Trek.
That's true.
Is that what you're talking about? When the whales are in space,
those are metric tons.
That wouldn't affect those.
That wasn't a whale. That was a probe, which was making contact with the whales.
Oh well, I thought they had.
I mean, let's be accurate here, okay? It looked like a giant Tylenol.
I love talking about Star Trek
with a soccer ball coming down the bottom.
Anything. Thank you very much, everyone, for that. Moving on. What's going on with earthquakes, Ben? Miles.
Earthquakes. Ah, way to switch stories. geologists in Italy, or who were studying an area in Italy, are actually being charged with a crime. Now, you would think, okay, well, anyone can be charged with a crime.
If you do something criminal.
But as it turns out, these geologists who were in an area of Italy, in L'Aquila, and checking out to see whether or not after some minor earthquakes, you know, a series of small earthquakes around the range of 4.0 or below, and seeing whether or not are these going to be something really major. Should we evacuate the area? And the geologists looked at their data and went, I don't think there's anything that warrants that. Less than a week later, a magnitude 6.3 earthquake hit the town. And now L'Aquila's chief prosecutor wants to charge them with gross negligent manslaughter.
Because they didn't predict it?
Because they didn't predict it and therefore get the people out of there.
Well, okay, so did they not do the mandated argument that every geologist should do? Like every time you talk to a geologist that does anything about earthquakes, they always say, earthquake will happen eventually at some point. We are not able to predict it, but it will happen. I mean, they did that, right?
Well, sure.
That's like
no scientist is ever going to say this is absolutely certain or absolutely not. You know,
only a bad scientist would.
Or correction, only a bad scientist would.
And
it is a tragedy that 308 people died.
Yes, absolutely.
But at the same time, it's kind of like expecting someone to say, like, next time make sure your crystal ball is correct.
Right.
Because this just doesn't work for me. You need to...
So they're actually getting charged with this?
Well, the chief prosecutor wants to, yes. I don't know how it's going about.
But it just seems like such an example of...
They are currently under
attacking...
formal investigation, though.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean... Have they seen in the past the ability for geologists to actually predict well enough to save lives? Have we ever seen that?
Yeah, but I mean, have these particular geologists done that?
No, what I'm saying is, it ever been a case where a geologist said, run everyone, run, and then everyone was saved?
Certainly. And there have been many cases where geologists have said, you need to get out of here now, and nothing has happened. And that's the big danger, actually, with earthquake prediction is, in the best case scenario, you would say, all right, there's a bad probability, you should probably get out. And if I'm wrong, sorry about that, but better to err on the side of caution. But
and then for nothing to happen, that would be the best case, actually.
Right, but it's very disruptive in people's lives.
Yeah.
And as soon as you have people evacuating a couple of times without anything happening, you start to lose faith in that people have like, oh, that's all bogus.
Mm-hmm.
And then you end up with people losing their lives. And you have to – because they can't predict the future. No, no matter how well educated or how much data you accumulate, you can't predict the future.
Thank you very much, Miles. I predict that Ben is about to give us a quick update on the sperm whale story.
I want to introduce our new Geek Fail segment, which is where one of the geeks gives a completely wrong statistic, like off by a factor of 12,000. And that's that sperm whales do not release 200,000 tons of carbon each year and absorb 400,000 tons. That's all 12,000 sperm whales in the Southern Ocean do that.
That sounds better.
Yes. And I was thinking about that, like, as I was doing the research, I just totally misread the first paragraph. So that would be 3.3 tons that, that the whales absorb.
That feels
3.3 tons. It's still a lot. It's still like...
Still more than me.
Four people's worth. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just saying, you just get seven more sperm whales and you have California's problem down.
I know.
And then...
Bada bing, right?
All right.
They were talking about, the history of whales and...
Yeah, how whaling really is.
Okay, we've beat this dead whale to... We're done with the story.
Oh. Okay, so oh, thanks.
Al, Instructables?
Hey, yeah. A listener named George sent in a link to what looks to be a crazy USB device. It's a USB mini fridge. But when I looked at the link, I realized that it's instructions on how to make a USB mini fridge. Now, I do these crazy USB devices, but when you make something, that's entirely different. When you go out to thrift stores and Radio Shack or wherever you want to solder together your own project, that takes on a geekiness that I think many of us can relate to. It's no longer a product of some large manufacturing facility trying to cash in on people who buy goofball things. It's something of your own doing. The website that I saw this on is called Instructables. Maybe some of you are familiar with it.
Awesome.
I've linked to it a couple times for other things, but never for itself. It's got lots of cool projects in there, like how to build a solar-powered lawnmower, instructions on making your own speakers, bent wood birdhouses. You get the picture. It's all these do-it-yourself things. So if you're ever looking for something to do on the weekend... Instructables.com, not a bad choice. It's just another neat little thing where you can go and find projects that maybe don't make any sense, but it's in the doing, not so much in the...
And it's kind of addictive looking through them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's one of those things where after you've looked through them for like 7 hours, you're like,
yeah,
why haven't I done something this time?
Right.
I could have made a cat door that opens for only my cat. Darn
right.
It.
I know.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So Instructables on USB fridge, which will not be a crazy USB of the week?
It will not, although I want to thank the listener, George, who emailed that into our Geek Speak.
But you will have a crazy USB of the week at the end of the show today?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It is crazy.
We don't have enough time, but speaking of tonnage that we spoke about a lot this episode, what's going on the moon?
Yeah, I want to talk about weighing water now. So just a few days ago, NASA announced that, according to recent research, the moon may have actually more volume of water than the Great Lakes on the Earth. Now, I mean, that's saying a lot, considering for a long, long time we thought the moon was made of cheese, and then after that we thought the moon was dry and had no water. So now we know the moon has water. Now we know that it has a lot of water, actually, relative to... I mean, it's not like
relative
water on
Earth. Water supply or something, but
yeah,
it's
exactly. Because the moon
is
very
big.
Is it
fresh water or not? I guess it's frozen.
It's hydroxyl.
Fresh.
It's in the form hydroxyl in the rocks, actually.
Oh, okay.
And so the study that they did looked at two Apollo samples and one of the lunar meteorites that they had collected. Mm-hmm. And the water content of those samples was between 64 parts per billion and 5 parts per million. So
are you sure those numbers aren't off by 20?
No, those aren't off now. thank you.
Sure.
Calls everything I say into question, right? So that's over 100 times what we'd previously detected and thought the amount of water on the moon to be. So that's kind of exciting. I mean, as far as water on the moon goes, you know. And then also there's a quick study I just want to briefly mention, which says that University of Colorado Boulder. Their study said that that Mars may have been one-third ocean, so more water in space. That's one-third ocean 3.5 billion years ago.
Cool.
So a really long time ago.
Well, thank you.
And I'll put a link up to that on the GeekSpeak site.
And everything we do on GeekSpeak is linked up on our site. Today's show, of course, is the 19th of June, and that means if you go to geekspeak.org and look up 2010 19th of June show, which is pretty easy to navigate to, you can find all the stories we've covered, little blurbs about them, links over to the primary story, and even sometimes notes that we make during the show. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam, Al Luckow, and Ben Jaffe. And now we have Andy Denmark. He's the co-founder and VP of engineering for TripIt, a travel management application and service. Andy's responsible for all application development as well as network and server operations. Andy, doesn't that put you in the hot seat for the whole company?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I make things work around here. So actually, my team makes things work. I just make sure they stay on the right path.
Now, your company, how big is it?
We're about 35 people now, okay, which is pretty amazing.
And so I'm going to break down kind of the general idea of how this works. You get your you book your reservation, you book your – oh, you know what? We'll be right back to this because Miles has to say.
KSP co-sponsors the Santa Cruz Chorale's concert presentation of Dvorak's Mass in D major for choir and organ. Conductor Christian Grube leads the chorale at three concerts. Friday, June 18th at 7 p.m. at Our Lady Help of Christians in Watsonville. Saturday, June 19th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, June 20th at 4 p.m. at Holy Cross Church in Santa Cruz. Tickets and information are available at 427-8023 or santacruzchorale.org.
All right, back to what's going on. So you book your reservations. Thanks, Miles. You book reservations through through the travel agency or maybe through some airline, and they send you an email confirmation. Then you book your hotel, and they send you an email confirmation. And the way that I normally travel is I'll kind of have those email confirmations pasted in, and I forward it off to a few friends of mine to make sure that they know where I am. And Miles drives me to the airport, so he needs to know the times and all that stuff. So I've got this kind of messy email in my phone thing. And you guys kind of just completely clean that up by being the one-shop space. So I forward all those messages to my TripIt account, and then my TripIt account has like a really clear itinerary of what I'm doing. Everything's in one place, and other features as well. Is that the general idea?
Yeah, I mean that's basically it. I mean the whole idea is to reduce the amount of work you have to do to actually get yourself organized for your trip. So just forward all those purchase confirmations to plans@tripit.com, and boom, it's done. You can share that trip with Miles, and he has no excuse anymore to be late to picking you up at the airport.
Oh, he has tons of excuses. So what do you mean? I mean, how does it process it? Is somebody in there kind of looking through it and figuring it out and typing into the database, or are you doing it all intelligently through?
We have an army of about 50,000 squirrels that are exceptionally good typists. The technology we built, it was the first thing that we started working on back in late 2006, actually mid-2006 at this point, was a technology that would allow us to pick apart the emails and intelligently, basically type them. So pull out important pieces of information, pull out the relationships between those pieces of data, and then send them along for further, in what we call a process called enrichment, where we actually can, based on the information that we're able to get from the email, actually, in some cases, add quite a bit more information about the travel object, whether it be a flight or a hotel.
I've seen this kind of stuff happen in banking situations. I'm pretty familiar with like Mint and a few other ones that they kind of are able to sync up some of the information that they have with other knowledge. But when you're talking about this, kind of it needs to be seamless, right? Because if you get an email confirmation from American Airlines and then it gets forwarded to TripIt, that better be the right gate that it was mentioned in the message. And sometimes these HTML messages are kind of messy in their structure. How do you actually do that? I mean, if American Airlines all of a sudden changes the way they send out their notification, does your system break for all American Airlines? How complex is it?
I mean, it depends on how big the change is. I mean, if the change is dramatic, then it will for a time be, it won't work for a time. But we have systems in place that help us figure that out very quickly. And the whole back end is architected so that we can be notified and respond to that kind of situation very quickly. And in a lot of cases, reprocess a lot of the mail that came through, during the period of time that it was broken.
If I go up to the TripIt account and I've just sent in the thing and I look at it, if it did have a fail, do I know that, or is it kind of hidden from me as a user?
It depends on how big the fail is. I mean, if it's a huge dramatic fail, then yeah, you'll absolutely be alerted to it. If it's more subtle, then it will take us some time to actually let the system alert us to that fact, and we'll catch up to it.
Sorry, I'm getting so geeky on it. I just understand that natural language processing is an extremely complicated thing to do. Can I ask?
To do well.
I can do that. He said yes. No, he didn't. What kind of programming environment are you in? At TripIt?
Well, we've got a number of environments across all of engineering. So we use a lot of, pretty much all of the technology that we use except for some of the mobile development environments, are open source. So, you know, we're using a lot of Python, PHP in the back end, MySQL, Memcache.
Are you doing your natural language processing with Python?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I figured. There's a lot of books on the subject. It seems to be the language of choice.
Yes.
Language de jure of language. So let's talk more about the application side. Ben, have you used TripIt?
Yes, actually, when I traveled through Europe, I used it.
I figured as much.
I used TripIt Basic, and then later I gave TripIt Pro a try, which is where they'll actually notify you to changes, like gate changes and things like that at the airport. And I don't know, I really liked, like, I think that services like this, and there are a few of them out there, I've kind of been, have my trying different ones.
Can we make sure to link a few of the other type of services like this?
Yeah, sure. Okay. But I've just been completely stunned at how easy it is to, when you have all that information in one place, right? That's ultimately the key. And if you have applications for your different mobile platforms, if you have a website, if you can integrate with a calendar, I mean, just having all of that information accessible wherever you are really changed the way I travel. It was absolutely fantastic.
Talk about the, you said you've got mobile apps. What platforms are you supporting?
Currently we're supporting the iPhone, of course, Android, which has been showing incredible growth lately, and then BlackBerry.
Okay, that's cool. So you got the main three covered.
Yes.
are you trying to make connections to travel agencies or other groups so that you're making sure to get the data correctly? In the sense that, like, if you did have hooks into other companies like American Airlines and things, it would be a lot simpler for you to know things like when a flight gets changed. Because I'm assuming you do that kind of notification.
Yes, for our pro users, like Ben was saying, and absolutely, to answer your first question, I mean, that is a huge part of what we're doing. So email was the great insight, the great first step.
Right.
Yeah, but we're also in the process. We've announced partnerships with companies like Hotwire and BCD Travel. BCD Travel, you probably heard of Hotwire. BCD Travel, you may not have heard of. I think it's the second or third largest travel management company in the world. It's where companies like HP and Apple, Pfizer, it's their travel agent.
Right.
So we're going to start seeing the itineraries for all of those corporate travelers flowing through TripIt's platform. And that will, of course, come in via the API, which is, kind of the other end of what we do for developers. And, you know, of course, you have a lot more precision, and the data will come in fully typed and very well defined.
It's interesting because this issue, of course, you're running into this hole. This thing is every hotel reservation system, every car traveler, rental car place, every airline, and other services of that nature have their own solution to this whole issue of, well, let's keep track of our members and the people that are using our services and email them and have abilities for them to change things and manage things, notification. They're all doing it separately. And, of course, the great joiner, if you will, is the email. But that's not a very valid way to deal with this kind of information because, of course, if your airline gets delayed by an hour and your rental car agency has a window of time when you're supposed to pick up, you kind of want some communication there that's simple. You want to be able to rebook your reservation or get the limo service that's picking up to be changed the time. And you can't do that easily with juggling your email and, of course, going through airports which don't have necessarily good, stable communication. So this problem you're addressing is kind of a patch in some sense to not having kind of defined standards that exist to do these things. And I'm just wondering, do you see standard bodies kind of figuring out how to do this? And, of course, what are your thoughts on that? Do you see a solution emerging as an open source standard communication protocol for this kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't see standard bodies fixing this problem because the history of why this problem exists has to do more with business and competition in the travel industry and how it's kind of grown up than technology. Our approach to this problem is really, it's an idea that we've been talking about in the market. We call it the traveler-centric future. But basically the idea is that the consumer, and this is not something that TripIt necessarily, created. It's an idea that, has kind of made the web as powerful as it is today. The idea is that the consumer owns their data, that, they have the right to, take their data and manage it and use it in whatever way they want. And our job is really, as an open platform, is to take that data, consume it, normalize it, and make it available via the API to whatever applications they might want to use. I mean, you can think of this as the beginning building blocks, at least in the travel domain, of Tim Berners-Lee's vision of the semantic web. I mean, that is basically what we are doing for the travel domain, which is creating highly typed travel data available in a secure and safe way to whatever, you know, ancillary services you might want to use, whether that be a mobile application or another website or an expense reporting system, to the traveler to make their life and their traveling experience better.
Okay. We're speaking with Andy Denmark. He is the VP of Engineering for Tripit.com, or Tripit, and the website is Tripit.com. Ali, had a question?
Yeah, I had a question, Andy. Just for our listeners out there who aren't, you know, MySQL experts and database programmers and all that, can you give us maybe an interaction with your software? Say I'm, you know, Mr. Johnson, and I want to go on a trip. Can you take me from when he first signs up, and what exactly the advantages and how you would he would interact with you? So basically, take me from when he first signs up to he's back home again.
Right.
Yeah. So give me how the advantages, what you're providing.
Sure. Well, there's a few things. So let's say Mr. Johnson has bought his ticket to, you know, New York. He's going for a nice long weekend, and the beautiful thing to start using Tripit, you don't have to sign up. All you have to do is forward your email to plans@tripit.com. We will automatically figure out your identity based upon your email address. We will, of course, validate that you own that email address, but then then pick the itinerary apart, geocode it, figure out the time and all of the, you know, the context of that reservation, and place it in an itinerary for you. Once you've got that done, you can, you know, install the iPhone application or the Android application and hook that up to your Tripit account. You can set it up so that your trip to New York is published through your Facebook network or LinkedIn. If you want, you can, you know, if you're a Google Calendar user, you can install the iCalendar URL.
Is this happening? Is this something that's happening on your server? So I would log in and see my, I mean, you're keeping track of my itinerary, so it's on your server, right?
Yes.
And then I would go to your website and see, just to kind of check up and see if things change, more or less?
Yeah, well, if you're a pro user, we'll alert you to changes to the flight. If you're not, then you'll have to update them yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the other services, if you want to hook them up, it's completely opt-in. You don't have to do any of that if you don't wish to share. I mean, privacy is something that we also take extremely seriously. I mean, given the sensitive nature of travel, you may not want to let your Facebook network know. So, you'd have to go to the website to actually set all these things up.
And the benefit of this is that your itinerary, instead of trying to find the most recent email from your flight confirmation, it's at one website that you've logged into, or your app, the phone that you're using. It has the application installed on it. The other benefit I noticed that of the sharing, you were able to say to somebody else that they can come see your information.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of granularity is that?
It's up to you. So you can share, you can connect to someone on Tripit. It's just a simple Tripit connection. That will only give the connection visibility into the macro location of where you're going, so the primary destination of your trip. But you can also share at a trip level. So you can actually share with, you know, your friend who lives in New York who's going to pick you up at the airport, and you can share with them either as a collaborator or just a viewer of that trip. So that they can see, you know, your flight number and when exactly you're getting in and all of that kind of information, so they can pick you up.
Ben, did you find this useful when traveling?
I did. What I actually did was I set it up with my Google Calendar and had that. I subscribed to that Tripit calendar on my iCal. Actually, it was BusyCal, but same thing. So I had it on my Mac, just pushing to my calendar as well as pushing to my phone. My phone's an Android.
The calendar on your phone?
The calendar on my phone, right? So I have a calendar app that puts the upcoming notifications in the notification bar. So that was really easy to get to it that way. And all that information was there. And then if I needed to make any changes or if I wanted to see a longer version of my itinerary, then I could open up the Tripit application and actually get all the information there. And what I really liked about that solution, both of those things are cached on the phone. You don't actually need a data connection
right.
or any kind of connection to anything. to view that because it's actually cached on your phone locally.
I like the idea of using an application like a calendaring application to have this thing spit in the calendar entries, right? So you're not actually recreating the calendar entry. The phone, the flight leaves at this time, be at the airport at this time. It's actually just a sync or a subscription to
the The thing that I found actually most helpful, and the problem that I had before most was time zones. Because, you know, traveling between different countries, you're constantly going between different time zones. And so if your phone knows what time zone you're in, then you don't have to worry about missing your train by 1 hour or 4 hours or 9 hours or something like that. And when you when you forward your itinerary off to TripIt, assuming that you can trust TripIt's parsing engine, which I didn't have any problems with, then it will actually tell you the correct time based on what your time zone is. So like a combination of the airline and what times they list on the email, TripIt interpreting that, putting it to your calendar, and then your calendar figuring out what the time zone is based on your phone's current time zone, like all of that, it's kind of a long process, but it worked very seamlessly for me.
It's and interesting because I find that probably that kind of date parsing and figuring out what time zone and everything. I'm assuming that's the kind of brain power stuff you like to do, isn't it, Ben?
No, that's the stuff that I'm worst at. You know, like I'm good at calculus, but I'm bad at algebra because I always forget the carry of the one or something like that, you know, and so I always end up with the wrong answer because of some silly mistake. And that's happened to me before where I double checked the time something, you know, on a train departure or something like that. And then like 2 hours before, I decided to do it again and triple check it, and whoops, my train leaves in 40 minutes, and I'm a 35-minute walking away from the train station, so kind of have to rush out the door and hope I didn't forget anything and hope I can walk fast enough to get to the train station. So
we're speaking with Andy Denmark. He is the VP of Engineering at TripIt.com. We're talking about traveling with high technology. If you have questions or comments about our topic, please feel free to call us. Phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. You can ask Andy a question. Or the toll-free number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. How is technology changing travel, Andy?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a number of ways. Some of them are pretty obvious. Some of them are more far-reaching. I mean, I think that the biggest thing in travel right now is obviously the biggest thing everywhere else, which is mobile. I mean, mobile is such an obviously useful set of technologies for a traveler because a traveler is, by definition, mobile. So I think that, you know, letting all this data out of the huge silos that it had been locked up in for so many years and pushing it out to mobile devices, letting applications on those mobile devices interact with one another and help the traveler along during their journey is, you know, amazing, phenomenal, so useful for people.
I find when I'm traveling that going to find a terminal and a display of the flight times, it sure would be nice if I was actually getting that data on my phone because, of course, I have to go find it. And I remember last time I traveled, having to walk like three gates to look at the array of television CRT screens that told me where to go.
It
was kind of funny that I was actually frustrated by that because I have so much knowledge right in my hand. Of course, that knowledge is not available.
I know. I mean, before applications like TripIt would be able to push that stuff to your hand, you always find yourself wandering around the terminal looking for the departure screen. It's like, oh my God, they should have one of these every 20 feet.
Yeah, but to me, and it's exactly my experience. Is I remember thinking, gosh, this is kind of ridiculous. I've traveled so far, and of course, I'm at one area of the airport. It's not like I'm traveling that far. I'm walking a couple gates. It's not a big deal. But the frustration is such that I can, in my palm, without traveling anywhere, I can find out the definition of any word, the Wikipedia entry of any item that's ever been created, thousands of sets of knowledge, any website, that I can do right where I am. But the information about where my next flight, when my plane leaves and where, I have to walk a few gates. To me, it's startling that I was frustrated by that. It's only walking a couple gates.
Well, I would say it's not actually only walking a few gates because you can't leave your luggage unattended at any time anywhere in the terminal. Otherwise, security will confiscate it, and we all know.
Yeah.
So you have to pack up. If you have your laptop out, you have to close your laptop, put it in your bag, unplug your charger, coil up your charger, put it in the bag, pick up your bag, take your other bag, drag it halfway across one gate, and then
Thanks
you know,
for that.
Come back.
Thanks for that clarification. That it is more frustrating.
It's more frustrating. Yeah.
Hey, we got a quick question on something a little bit different. But earlier we were talking about 1.5 watts per kilogram with respects to cell phone and how much radiation your head is picking up.
1.6, yeah.
1.6 watts. How does that relate to, depending on the weight of the person, why does that, I mean, does that matter that much? If you've got a smaller head, I mean, doesn't
right.
seem to be.
It's funny. I was just writing that up for the website, so okay. we'll get more information on that. But the issue isn't so much the weight, the overall weight of the person. It's over a specific area, and then you're talking about whether or not it's ionizing versus non-ionizing.
Right.
Right. Ionizing radiation, basically, it's does the electromagnetic radiation have enough
energy?
Or actually, this is radio waves, so I guess it's electromagnetic radiation. Does it have enough energy to knock an electron out of its orbit? In other words, does it have enough energy to have DNA replication fail
major,
or
right.
cause a mutation, mm-hmm. that type of thing? And 1.6 watts per kilogram is a unit of saying how much energy is going into a specific area. So whether you are, you know, 50 kilograms or less or more, it doesn't really matter so much.
Because if you're larger and it's spread out more, like the cell phone's farther away from you, it's even less radiation.
Right. Our cells are always the same size.
Right. And how much is the maximum amount of tissue you could heat up? How much wattage is going into the smallest area, basically?
Right.
Meaning the closest the phone possibly could be to your head. Like taking the antenna and sticking in your ear kind of thing.
Right. And if you are really worried about that type of... if you're worried about the electromagnetic radiation hitting you and causing a problem, you really should worry about going outside with the sun.
Right.
Because that is so much
and
more...
ionizing.
Yeah. Yeah. It is so much more energy.
Yeah. And the reason why we do ultraviolet, you know, we're concerned about ultraviolet radiation is ultraviolet radiation is ionizing. So it's more damaging to the tissue, of course, than your cell phone, actually, which is not because of the amount of energy in it.
Right.
I'm assuming.
And when we talk about the cell phone, this is 1.6 watts per kilogram when the phone is held up next to your body, when it's just out and about.
And the other thing is every study we've seen in large-scale studies of this show no applicable difference of having a cell phone or not having a cell phone for different types of maladies that might emerge, like brain cancer. The most recent studies show no difference. The only thing to note about that is that it's unclear in a developing body because we don't have studies of that. It's harder to determine what happens to a child with a cell phone. So if you want to be more precautious, don't let your kid use your cell phone or don't let them use it very much. And it's all about volume when you're talking about tissue damage from radiation. The more tissue damage there is, the more time and duration, the more potential for damage. So limit it. And that's probably a good sign for a small kid anyway. Teenagers are probably safe. Ben, you have something else?
Oh, I had a question for
Andy. Let's go. Andy is still with us. Hi, Andy.
Hey.
Yeah, my question is, I'm kind of curious, in your experience or in your staff's experience, is it particularly difficult to develop for one of those three mobile platforms? Like, which of those platforms is most fun to develop for and which is easiest to develop for, which takes more or less time?
Yeah, it's pretty simple and probably not surprising. I mean, iPhone and Android are probably the, you know, relatively easier and fun platforms to develop for, both because of their development environments and also because of the capabilities of the platforms. BlackBerry is, you know, by far the most challenging, you know, both because of the variety of devices that are available, but then also the customizations that the carriers are able to do, plus the different environments that it can run within. You know, is it connected to a BES server? Is it not? You know, if it is connected to a BES server in the context of a corporate IT department, is it, you know, how is that server configured? I mean, all of those things really contribute to, you know, differences in the phones, which can result in bugs and poor user experiences.
Does it feel like for each of these platforms you have to rewrite a lot of code or less code or the entire thing?
You can share ideas, obviously. I mean, we're writing, you know, similar applications. They've got to consume the same data. But, it's iPhone's all Objective-C, Android and BlackBerry are Java. They're very different. So you're basically rewriting the whole thing from scratch.
Yeah, and of course you're reusing your API. So your API, as it grows, is beneficial to all the platforms. The API,
absolutely,
of course, is the application environment, API,
programming
environment. right? No.
Interface.
Thank you. Environment with an I doesn't work. Yeah. And that is basically the way that what you were talking about earlier, people that write code can actually use that API. So if, for example, I wanted to kind of manage my own website with travel information, I want to put the travel information up on the right-hand side for some reason of my itinerary, I would write some PHP code that would connect to your servers through your API and allow me to pull in information and republish it. And that ability, that API openness ability, is the reason we have this kind of reemergence of Web 2.0. Like, the reason why I can show Flickr images on my website is because of their API. And this is kind of the way that we've gotten across the standards issue. Everybody publishes their own way to access and add their information in a very open way with good documentation, and anyone can do that. And that's a pretty great step forward. Are you seeing your API versus another? I mean, are you the biggest company that does this? Is there a competitor that's larger? Are you seeing you guys doing different things? Are you all kind of copying each other? Give me the state of that realm.
Well, I mean, in terms of the API, I think, you know, of the companies that I know about that are in a similar space, we're the only one that currently has an open API. So
that helps you.
It does. Right. I mean, I think it's fundamental to the way we view the world and our strategy. I mean, we're looking well beyond not only our own applications, but also, you know, travel. There's a lot of companies that are starting to hook up to TripIt's API that aren't even travel companies. And that's exactly how it should be, because that benefits the traveler. And it goes back to the view of the world where the consumer, the traveler, is at the center. Their information, and they should, you know, use it for their benefit.
Thank you, Andy. Andy Denmark is the VP and co-founder, VP of Engineering and co-founder of TripIt, a travel management application and service. You can learn more information at geekspeak.org. Andy, thanks so much for being here.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Take care.
Coming up next is the crazy USB of the week. But first, I want to let you know that Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along, too. That's Wait, Don't Tell Me. Today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Al?
Hi, this is Al Lacow with GeekSpeak's Crazy USB Device of the Week. This next device has to rank as one of the craziest, most useless USB devices ever conceived and manufactured. It's called the two-fingered USB eye massager. It looks like a little plastic arm with a hand on the end making the gesture of a peace sign. It comes in four colors, which to me seems to be the most useful feature. What this does is sort of vibrate. You have the choice of two speeds, and the manufacturer expects you to put this on your eyeballs. Presumably, you close your eyes first, otherwise it becomes more of a Three Stooges device. They claim that in addition to massaging your eyeballs, it also aids digestion, fights infection, and stimulates the lymphatic system.
No.
Overall, in my opinion, the most important control on this device is probably the stop switch. This is a silly, silly device which embodies the idea of crazy USB device perfectly. The actual link will be up on geekspeak.org after the show.
Thank you, Al. Just to be clear, you're not even supposed to rub your eyeballs with your own fingers, you know, let alone vibrating ones.
It's just, I don't know what to say. I thought I'd seen everything. I thought I was going to run out of things, but
you know, you're not running out of things.
Something like this
pops
up.
Buy this now that we've advertised it, too.
Don't buy this thing. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KUSP.org. All the stuff we do on GeekSpeak, all the links and all that is up on our website, geekspeak.org. The Geeks Today, Miles Elam, Al Luckout, Ben Jaffe. I'm Lyle Troxell. Stay tuned now for Car Talk.